Because I have a recording, you will not have a quorum because of session.
Okay, yeah, and, excuse me, assumed that was probably going to be the case, so, okay, good enough. All right, good morning, everybody. We'll get started with planning and operations. No public comment on the agenda, and no one signed up for any comment this morning, so we have no old business, so we will go directly to new business, 2025 year in review.
Thanks, I'll be pretty short on this, mainly because I'm not going to have a voice by the end of the day, I think. So the 2025 year in review is put forth in your packet. It's really just there to provide you some snippets of information that came through on the operational side of the house of things for planning and such. So really, I just open it up to see if there's any questions or any other information that you guys might think would be beneficial or helpful in trying to wrap your head around the stadium S plan.
Questions, anything? Everybody have a chance to review it?
Joe, I just have a question to try to educate me on your graph that says request versus transport trend.
Yeah.
You said that there were the blue line request all transfer request, which was 400, little over or half under for over 450,000, but we only took 280,000.
Yeah, so it's actually requests for service, not necessarily requests for transfer. So that's all 911 calls, all requests for service.
That was going to be my question, is where that data came from. Whether,
yeah, so it's,
I mean because sometimes, you know, a hospital may call the service directly rather than ever going through a dispatch center.
Sure. So it's all requests for service reported into us, which our services are required to report all requests for service.
Standby events, everything.
Yep.
Okay.
In that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Great question. Very good question.
Anybody else? Questions, comments? No? Nothing?
Well, before I said something I'm not supposed to.
Making sure you were, but didn't think you were at an auction and accidentally hold up your hand or something.
No.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's no other questions on that part, we'll go to the next item on the agenda. So discussion on reserve vehicles, backup vehicles, out-of-service vehicles, discussion related to whether regulations should address the regulatory requirements differently for these types of vehicles. If so, and how are they defined and identified as such? So that was information that's been sent out and discussion as well has been had. So I know we've received a couple of letters addressing this. That were written comments back to the committee and back to the board. So, Joe, go ahead if you want to kind of give an overview of everything, and then we can have some discussion on it.
Yeah, so the board brief on this item covers pretty much what I would end up saying. So, really, it's just a result of looking through the inspections, some of the things that were being found, and really the justification being provided to the inspectors as to why it was being found. A lot of it makes sense. The problem that they encountered is it's not in compliance with the regulation as it's currently written. So probably a great opportunity to look at the regulation, to consider updating, to allow for these other situations, which, again, a lot of them made great sense. So if you have a truck that is never going to provide ALS care because of the location where it's at and the personnel that are there and everything else, Why should it necessarily be equipped with all of the ALS equipment? And when we granted the flexibility within the regulation to say, hey, just stock your truck with the equipment necessary to execute your medical protocols, the reason they're having to keep ALS equipment on it is because their medical protocols still have ALS level interventions being performed for that area. So It's just, it was a byproduct of trying to grant flexibility, not necessarily seeing all the way down the road that this might cause a little bit of a disconnect later. So really just having that flexibility to look at the truck is what it comes down to and what its primary role is and on that given day. So the ideas thrown out were, you know, reserve, backup, because those are kind of the terms that have been used when we've asked things. We've heard last out. Spare is another one. And then the only term that regulation currently has is out of service. But out of service, really in the context, looks like it was primarily designed to be a temporary thing, like long enough to disinfect something. Because that's exactly the context it was used in, and the regulation is, hey, your ambulance is considered out of service until it's disinfected. There's just probably some room for improvement there.
So is this something that you would foresee that if an ambulance is in reserve status, that how is that reported, I guess? How is it going to be handled if that unit needs to be placed into frontline service? Is that a notification has to be made to the board office, or?
I don't know that there's a notification that needs to be made other than a delineation as to what they are. Again, our inspectors will inspect what they see on the day that they're there. So if there's six frontline ambulances, I think it was one of the examples in the one of the comments, then we would expect to see six frontline ambulances stocked as their frontline ambulances are stocked. So with their, or equipped and ready to go, however they say their frontline unit is. And so it would probably need to tweak the regulation to allow that difference so that a frontline ambulance could be stocked or dealt with differently than every other ambulance. Again, your regulation is written for an all or none approach. So every single unit has to be this is what it's currently written at. It's just really, that's not our situation right now. So it's a horrible way to answer your question, Shane, but.
No, I'm just trying to think of, I mean, if it's a, and I read the letters from Frank and Dave Johnson on that, and we're in a very, our service is in a very similar situation of having reserve ambulances that, for the most part, are staffed, or not staffed, but stocked, and it's not uncommon for us to have to take staff off of a fire truck due to high call volume and put them on a reserve ambulance to run a call. With the exception of a mechanical CPR device, that's about the only thing that's not on those reserve ambulances. Otherwise, they're fully stocked, just like they would be if they were a frontline truck. But not everybody has that capability or latitude to have that even that much equipment for reserve ambulances that they would have to physically, whether it's cardiac monitor or whatever it may be, have to take equipment off of that frontline ambulance to put on a reserve ambulance to push that into service. So I'm just trying to figure out how that would be navigated on that whole part of that. If it's still allowed to utilize that reserve ambulance to respond to calls, even though it may not meet everything?
It's however you tell us to use it. Right now, they're all available. They're all permitted. You use them as you use them. And I would say that needs to remain in whatever solution comes out of this discussion. Because I think the flexibility does need to exist for a service to say, I should be able to put that in with the reserve equipment on it for exactly the scenario you just provided.
Sure.
And then the only other aspect, because we focus a lot on the ground side, and I'll turn to Craig and throw him on the spot on this one, because they handle spares completely differently
right.
than what the ground side does. And so in the fact that having next to nothing in equipment on a spare air ambulance, because they're going to take everything out of the one, and that's the whole weight balance thing, I believe. Craig, is that kind of somewhat fair?
Well, the equipment has to be put in the same places on each aircraft, no matter if you're in a 407, you have a mount for your ZOL, and it goes here, and if you want to move it from this spot to this spot, you have to redo the op specs. It's a whole process, so they all go in the same place, but from a Yes, from a spare aircraft perspective, they come from the D minus the onboard O2 and the onboard section. There's nothing else. We have a hangar in Hayes that has a spare aircraft that's dedicated to Kansas that sits in Hayes, and there's nothing on it. So whichever base needs it, it'll get flown to that base. We take all the stuff off the main aircraft, it's, put it on there.
Right. Not like a reserve ambulance where... A flight crew can't just go jump in that and take off and go take a transport a patient.
I would venture to guess that there's probably rural ambulance services, whether they're firebase or not, would be in the same situation as the flight service in that case, where they don't have the ability to keep a lot of their reserve ambulances stocked to the full tilt if it's a reserve ambulance. So it could be empty, would be my guess.
Or close to it.
Yeah, or close to. We're not fixing things today, but what do we need to do to get this switched fairly rapidly? I think we're all fairly in agreement. I don't think there's a huge disagreement on the. Sure. We just need to change the language. So what do we need to do that?
Yeah, I just need to know what we need to change the language to. To be able to get that draft up and going and started and head out. I will say that I don't think we've encountered many ambulances that are licensed that are empty, ground ambulances.
Some reserve.
It'd be less than five if we have. Now, we have seen some that are absolutely less stocked, but we haven't seen any that are just shells. Most of the ones that were shells that we've seen have been kept as a, they'll call it as a mass casualty unit. So, and really it's just full of stuff that they just want to be able to transport to a scene to be able to utilize and such. So that we've asked, since there's no intent to ever transport a patient in it, probably don't want to consider that an ambulance. It could look like one, but.
Well, in the document, there's a couple of different items or suggestions that, if the board's intent is not to maintain an all-or-none approach, which I don't feel it is or should be or would be, at least that would be the recommendation for the full board, is that this is not an all-or-none approach. This is a situation where we need to have language to allow flexibility for individual services to have that capability. And Jared, you're shaking your head. I would assume your reserve or backup ambulances are not equipped for a... If it's a truck or a single truck, or if you have more than one that's not a frontline staffed ambulance on a routine basis, may not be as equipped as what your frontline staff truck is.
Right, and I mean, we're in much better shape than a lot of smaller services, I know, but the primary difference in ours would be like Lucas. And primarily our ACLS drugs and narcs, I don't keep on our third truck. They're on our first two that we alternate calls with. The question I would have, I guess, if you're going to throw one of these in, one of them goes down, they have to go to shop, so that ambulance gets brought in. If you come and do an inspection on that day, and we submit an equipment list for those individual trucks, and this truck says, I don't have those drugs, I don't have a Lucas, but I've sent one of mine to the shop, so I move that stuff over. What does that do? And the second question, I know, you know, regs and changes happen so rapidly, change in language, that...
Correct.
Yeah, well, so looking at a very real possibility of two inspections before the language actually gets changed and approved, what happens in the meantime?
Because we're already doing it.
I think it's the way it's already been, and we've been inspected for years, and kind of just that understanding that...
It's a backup.
I mean, if my third truck's not in the station... It's a real bad day. Or that truck occasionally gets sent to a football game if we have two football games in the county the same night, strictly with the BLS crew, which that truck is completely capable of fulfilling our BLS protocols.
And that was going to be my next question.
And if
differentiation of protocols.
If you have a broken leg or something like that, our first truck's coming that's going to have the drugs and everything else that our ALS providers can do anyway.
Sure.
Well, but what's going to happen with the violations between now and then? Are we all going to have to go buy enough stuff to stock every single one of our ambulances to the guild and then try to sell it on Purple Wave after this gets done?
Yeah, and what's the floor in the situation of the standby for BLS? I mean, they're staffed to BLS, so their scope of practice within the protocols only
goes to that level.
To their what would be their ceiling. So even if there was equipment there, that wouldn't be necessary.
But to his point, you've got a spare ambulance or a reserve ambulance that is stocked to the BLS level, and that's all he needs. He doesn't need right. the ALS stuff, so you almost need an equipment list. Type 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. Remember Craig brought up type 1, type 2.
I mean, you're back to an equipment list that matches the provider level versus this one-size-fits-all protocol. I mean, right now our equipment lists and medication lists are to the highest level of the protocols because that's what we're required to do, even though we run trucks with A's and an EMT, and then I've got a truck with a medic and an EMT, and so that A isn't doing everything that medic's doing, but they're in the same trucks that we have, and you're going to have lists for, and then I've got trucks that do shuttles, and they have completely different, they have the state minimum in them, because that's all they do.
Well, and in that situation, in your shuttle, you guys ended up developing a completely different protocol, right?
Yeah, we now have a protocol for the truck.
Yeah.
That says this truck does not provide care.
And that was Yeah, that was the all or none principle because we never addressed that component. So it was an ambulance. It had to meet their protocols. Their protocols said this is what we were going to do because even though it was limited.
Point. We've been doing it that way. I mean, I've been here 12 years and that's the way it's always had been and there's never been a,
Well, it's always been a violation. It just hadn't
sure.
been recognized.
No, I get that.
That's the other component to it. Yeah.
So I guess that the point of that is it's clearly not caused any harm to anyone. It's not posed a problem. So it just shows that that's an easy thing to be done and can be done. And
mm-hmm. So the terminology that's in here and the staff recommendation is that the staff believes that the addition of two different statuses, so whether the terminology of a reserve, which would be a truck that is capable of being pushed into service immediately if necessary, and then the status of backup, which would be missing equipment, missing supplies, kind of along the lines of your spare aircraft thought process, which could apply to, the way I'm interpreting this would apply to ground ambulance services that have a spare or a backup truck that maybe potentially could run a BLS call with equipment and supplies that are in it, but doesn't necessarily have everything in it to execute their full ALS protocols if they're an ALS service. That's my interpretation. Now, I may be wrong. I've been accused of interpreting things incorrectly a time or two. So. But I guess that's my recommendation that having that capability, the services need to have that flexibility, I guess, in my opinion. That's something that, you know, even for our service that, you know, we've got reserve ambulances that essentially the only thing they're missing is the crew and maybe mechanical CPR device literally would be the only thing missing as a reserve ambulance. But those reserve ambulances it's not uncommon for them to have a off-duty crew come in to take a interfacility transfer in that truck. And take a patient. So,
and I would ask, Mr. Chairman, about the reference to the out of service and how embedded in the definition. How does that really apply?
Right.
Is that an overall definition that would apply to those things that we just mentioned? Because
is it anything that keeps that truck from being able to respond to a call? So,
right.
If it's A, being disinfected for whatever purpose or whatever reason, mechanical issues that it's in the shop. How that's defined, is that what you're
yeah, and just having those two.
What falls under out of service?
It seems complex, and, you know, I could say this is a reserve unit today, or it's a spare today, when an inspection happens or however that's vetted or accountable to the board. But out of service and available or in service seems like a simple delineation.
Yeah, I think it's simple that just simply the fact that you can't physically get in that truck and respond to a call right now.
Yeah.
That it is out of service.
Yeah. And
for whatever reason, mechanical, safety, disinfection,
equipment,
whatever it may be. Yep.
Yeah. Which would also apply to those opportunities you have when you're coming back from a call and a monitor's failed or something's happened in that period of time until you can make arrangements. I mean, that's all operational control, and that's our biggest vet in our system is Medic 1, Medic 2 know what's available, what's not available,
sure.
and what's missing. So.
So is there an opportunity that a policy, because our protocols encompass any kind of call, any kind of provider, but if we have an internal policy for specific types of responses, like our community response vehicles, would a policy suffice in that same situation? Have the minimum equipment, but then they have a specific signed-off standardization list specific to that response type vehicle.
So the quick answer is that a operational policy at a local level wouldn't be able to supersede a regulation. We'd still have to address that component within the regulation to potentially allow it. So that, granting that flexibility, that route to say, this could be addressed via a policy side of things might be a solution.
Very microscopic.
But yeah, as of right now, it wouldn't.
You have to be careful not to get too deep in the weeds. And I would tell you the reason for that is because when you get out west of Topeka, there's lots of people in places that don't have the equipment. And you already licensed the truck. And I would tell you, we were religious in both the services I worked for to say it's not the truck that saves you, it's the people. And often people would come in a support vehicle, including myself, with a monitor and oxygen and some basic medications, because now a Boy Scout can pretty much run a code. And the box is merely the transporting vehicle. And you already licensed those. I think maybe if it's an inspection issue, rather than making it a problem that we probably might not have, is you deal with that with the policy in the department internally to be able to identify when you walk into a service. And I can tell you right then that truck is a reserve truck, or that truck is a backup truck, or that truck needs new tires, or whatever. And that way, I think if you try to do that, if you try to look at all those things, it's an inspection problem. Is that what it is?
So it's not an inspection problem. It's a problem with the regulation. The regulation right now is an all or none approach. That what you just explained is not allowed. It is either if we are issuing a permit, you've said that it has all of the equipment necessary to do the medical protocols that are for that service,
right,
has to match the list of equipment that's there, everything else, and it doesn't take into account the other variables at all. So the regulation itself is, I mean, it's dated. It's not real recent. I mean, 12
right.
years maybe. So it's really that all or none approach versus granting that flexibility. And the one flexibility piece that we did allow with not having a specified number of 4x4s and all of the other fun stuff that used to be in there,
mm-hmm.
And just saying that you have the equipment necessary to execute your medical protocols actually kind of evolved this issue further. Because there is flexibility now granted within the regulation for equipping, but there wasn't necessarily the flexibility to say that you could treat this truck differently than this truck or this aircraft different than this aircraft. So it's just a natural evolution. This is what happens with regs. It's nothing horrible, just evolution.
Sure.
So basically you're just looking for direction on how to differentiate. Since we don't have a quorum to actually take action, but we can still give a recommendation that define what a reserve ambulance is, or and define what a either backup or spare ambulance is. We already know what out of service means, but that's already addressed. But is that kind of what you're looking for? If it's the desire of the committee to move that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got notes written down to kind of address what I think would be the next steps on going into the actual drafting of a regulation. And then I can bring that back to this body, or if you want to, I mean, you can meet as frequently as you like.
Sure.
As a committee, so I don't have to wait till April if you don't want to. We can try to move it quicker. I heard the urgency, and I echo the urgency.
We would offer up, as a KEMS organization, we've gotten some anecdotal feedback already, and we've got a survey that's getting ready to go out. We wouldn't wait on that, but we'd be happy to craft something to bring forward as a recommendation.
As far as language, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's up to you, Joe. It's
welcome to help.
Sure.
Okay.
I think the goal is to try to differentiate this. So, and if that's what needs to occur, that's what needs to occur. But
do we need to look at the lists as well as from an ALS, BLS standpoint while we're doing this?
So I guess that was going to actually, that was actually one of my questions. And I don't know how many other agencies clearly differentiate ALS protocols versus BLS protocols. You know, if it's a reserve ambulance but has equipment on it to meet the agency's BLS protocols, at least, is it an issue versus meeting the full extent of if they have a couple of ALS providers, but there are times that even during the day that the on-duty crew may not be an ALS crew that day, and they're only able to function at their BLS protocol level of service, how to differentiate that or not?
So in the scenario of it changing on a daily basis, I'm not sure that we have a service that's going to go in and grab all the ALS equipment and yank it off the truck for a six-hour period.
Sure.
Where there's a BLS provider there. So I think they're probably going to stock it. It might be a scenario we don't necessarily need to address.
Okay.
However, we do know that there are ambulances within areas where there's only BLS responders that might grab that ambulance to go respond to a call, and that's a situation that we do encounter fairly frequently in Northwest Kansas, probably also in Southwest. I just haven't heard it reported back to me that way, where they do have an ambulance in a location where the only providers within 8 minutes of the station are BLS providers.
Sure.
They won't stock that truck with ALS equipment or meds because the likelihood of it expiring is higher than it being used.
Sure.
And they're not going to rotate it back through because they just simply won't use it there. And they're going to send a truck with ALS providers out to them.
Right.
So what I would, and I'll tell you just in the conversation, the portion where we say that equipment and such is based off the protocols, I had basically taken the note that that needed to be tweaked to say that the equipment that needs to be on the truck is probably more based upon whether it's a first out unit versus one of these other things, whatever it is. The front line, I think, was the term that was used in the comment that
right.
We like. That's a great term. Because those front line trucks are probably going to be stocked identically to
sure.
What the expectations are of the county. And then everything else after that, people do understand, hey, you know, I walk into the grocery store and things are empty on the shelves. It's not because they don't want to have it there. It's because they can't have it there at that point. So same thing with the ambulances, I think, is where it comes down. They very much would understand, hey, all six frontline ambulances were out. Ambulance number seven's coming to get me. It probably doesn't have everything that all the other six had on it. So I think there's that flexibility where we'd end up tweaking that one component to say it's not tied to a truck now. It's tied more towards the status of what that truck would be. And that's fine. It helps us with an inspection as well coming through because we know.
And I heard comment or question in reference to what happens with those cases that have already been identified now. Is that something that will go forward with investigations and a discussion, or is that something that this discussion manages?
As in everything, we have to affect law as in what the law says today. So it'll still get put forth as a violation, and
doesn't,
the investigations
but does not mean any action. It may simply be identified that a violation occurred and local action was accepted or and doing nothing with them until this is resolved. Because it, I think this scenario and this issue is going to impact everybody.
Yeah, it sounds like it's been a culture for decades now. And to have that come forward now as punitive action, which is how everybody perceives that, is
right.
That's pretty hard.
Sure. So. Agreed. Okay. So you've got some notes and language that you've identified. I guess the biggest thing is identifying, you know, reserve or and what the other reserve and out of service. We know what those are. So, you know, frontline, in service, we know what that means. Reserve, we know what that means. The terminology for the either spare or backup terminology is probably the only one that needs to be identified as to what that is, and I guess from my perspective, but that way it's clear for everybody on what those definitions mean as this moves forward. So is that what you're hoping for today? Not necessarily a clear
publication of what's going to be in there. Okay. What route to kind of somewhat take, and that is a great conversation because that does start it, and yeah, sure. Looking forward to, I mean, you guys provide what you need to provide because that's awesome too. The only other thing we didn't necessarily talk about, but that I know is also currently an issue, and that is when a truck is out of service, there is currently a regulation requirement that says there's only certain things that can be set aside when that truck itself is out of service, and that's anything that's a requirement on the truck. So thinking of this in the regulatory aspect, 2.5 says as a service, this is your responsibility. 2.8 says here's what the truck has to have on it and such. When the truck is out of service, it eliminates the requirements in 2.8, but still keeps the requirements of 2.5. So the easiest one, the example to use is the fact of an ambulance has to be, the operator's required to park an ambulance in a garage with a solid concrete floor kept at 50 degrees. That requirement can't get set aside in our current regs. That's a requirement of the operator to stuff. So if even if you yanked absolutely everything off of the truck, that licensed truck, which is probably the reason why we said it needed to be inside was so things don't freeze.
Sure.
Technically, a service is in violation for parking that truck outside because it has to be parked or stored in an enclosed building. So there are some, there's others, but that's the biggest one. That's where the statement we said this might bleed over into the operational side of things as well as 10925 does have some.
So there definitely needs to be some language there for 2.5 then to differentiate that. But if, because I can tell you right now, when a truck goes back to the dealership for factory repair, whatever that may be, if it has to go out of your agency to a repair shop, the likelihood of that truck being parked inside at all other than when it's being worked on is pretty slim. Okay. Now they may pull it in a couple of the places we take ours, they do agree and they'll pull it back inside at night, mm-hmm. when they close for the day when nobody's going to be around. But while they're waiting on parts or what have you, it's sitting outside in the parking lot, whether it's 105 or -5. So language in there that differentiates that if you're taking it out of service or it's going to be parked outside, that anything susceptible to temperature, the temperature environment, whatever that may be, needs to be removed. Would that capture that, something along those lines?
I guess my biggest thing in addressing that is I would just know a solution that we were going to provide was going to tweak, probably modify that as well.
Okay.
Because like that, I can't justify that in a regulation. Is really what it comes down to, is there are certain things that need to be set aside. Now, if you gave a good argument as to why it needed to stay in there, then great, we'll keep it in there, but there doesn't really seem to be one right now, and
okay.
You've got the brain trust around the table to figure that one out. So,
Mr. Chairman, just reading through that same regulation, I don't know whether G and H run concurrently. G references the 50 degrees and the concrete building. Then right below that is each licensed ambulance shall meet all regulatory requirements for the ambulance license type, except when the ambulance is out of service. So it seems like that goes back to the reference in the definition about a service. I understand the and agree with the intent. We don't want to freeze medications. We don't want to expose right. those. Your scenario, Mr. Chairman, is the same that we have all the time. So that may be some flexibility there, too, to lean on that language for it.
Okay. So the statement, the section that you just stated, that's how we get around eliminating 2-8.
Okay.
That's what eliminates 2-8.
Gotcha.
When that truck is out of service, but it doesn't. The rest of 2-5 still has to be met because that is an operational requirement.
But something that could be reviewed, you said.
Yeah, we could.
109-2-5.
Yeah, we could tweak that and include it a little bit. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So that language will be worked on for an upcoming meeting, whether that's later this year, however that works. So, correct? And this is nothing that needs to go to the full board. This is something that you can work on now and start moving forward.
We can get it started now and okay. get going. It doesn't have to go to the full board for their
approval, final approval probably yes. will have to go. But
that it will. But I'm not sure we're there yet. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. Any other discussion on that item? Okay. So that was it on your new business parking lot. Just items awaiting further information or an outside recommendation prior to returning before the committee, and currently listed as the medication AEMT medication list. That's
correct. That's the ball's been dropped on my side of there. The MAC has been asked to try to get back together. I just haven't been able to get that coordinated yet. So okay. that's on me.
All right. Any other items that you guys would like to discuss that are not listed on the agenda at this point? All right. We can go around the table. Region. Organization updates?
Not a ton. We've been trying to get EMS providers involved in our regional LAPC to get some of that FEMA money allocated for EMS. I mean, we have Deb Brown and I, but we have two more seats at the table that I think we're gradually getting people invested, but it's really just kind of a lot of those discussions. We've talked regionally, working with KMSA, about maybe trying to set up some training too, and doing some moving around to different locations, some of the smaller towns in our region, maybe doing some quarterly or a couple times a year, like a Saturday training to help some of our volunteer services, but nothing in concrete by any stretch.
All righty.
Region 3 met in January. No real major discussions. We do have an upcoming in April pediatric symposium that's open to anyone. It's in conjunction with Ascension Via Christi. AMR and Sedgwick County, we're sponsoring that in Wichita. 6 hours of continuing education credit. And it would satisfy your pediatric education requirements for recertification. I think the only other thing I would like to add, we kind of miss, I don't want to say I miss Chad, but we miss having board representation at our meetings. So if there's anything that we can ever do to get, a board rep or a board staff to either give us, kind of a brief update. I think service directors, we are more in the know, but we get a lot of attendees at our meetings that I don't think have that same, update every 2 weeks. So just, Jerry's able to usually fill in for us. So it's not.
Sorry, Mr. Last meeting. No,
it's not often. But, I do want to stress that there is value, I think, in having, somebody there to just give updates to people that aren't in the know like the rest of us.
Okay. Thank you.
Kenny, I just thought you might want to add something before I, no? Okay.
Yeah, why do airplanes have, you know,
oh, I don't want to talk aviation.
How do you ask questions?
I didn't really mean to. We'll come back to, we'll table that. Okay. it's in the parking lot, yes. We have a meeting today at 2, so I don't have a lot. We didn't meet last in December. Our president-elect position is still vacant. We are working closely with the KDOT Emerging Aviation Group with some technologies that they're proposing, just more hearing them out versus, that's not really our arena, but kind of trying to walk beside them on some of that. And then for sure with a lot of the money they got for airport upgrades, they've been able to make some significant impacts in some of the areas that we identified as a Canadian organization to fix airports, to get planes into places where we weren't able to previously. So that's been, over the last couple of years, that's been a huge help for some of those Western places we all talk about that nobody get into. So that's all I got. It's now you.
KMSA's been busy. Yesterday we had the KMSA day at the Capitol. So we had about 45 attendees that registered and was able to schedule meetings for their legislators. Seemed to go quite well. Top of those priority lists are PTSD, which is being revisited again with the law enforcement and our firefighter friends, and how that looks outside of workman's comp. So there's some working plans there with lobbyists. Rural health transformation, which I'll get to here in just a second, was just a placeholder with legislators, as most of that's underway. And Joe may have some more information from his perspective at some point. So it was a good day overall. And some discussion about MIH, again, that rolls into some of that rural health transformation and other projects. Other upcoming events, the Educator BLS Examination Preparation Workshop is being held out in Colby April 11th. We have a NSIMSE Level 1 instructor course June 12th through the 14th in Wellington. So several things already planned. May 1st, May Day it sounds like, is going to be our golf tournament this year. So look forward to that. Rural health transformation, MIH, CP, again, Jason may have something to contribute, but we put a toolkit up on our website for KMSA if you're interested. There's a lot of reference documents there to go research and look at to help understand, or if you're already planning for that, some good tools for you to reference. And then rural health transformation. I understand that the state's supposed to get back information hopefully by March 1st on how that looks. Our proposal, as we last updated, was received and included. And then there was lots of massaging of that before it was put in as a final document. Was that accurate? Yes, okay. So we continue to struggle as EMS entities to be present at the table. We appreciate the support of the board, and KMSA's tried really hard to be at every meeting or be involved today. Both Dave Johnston and Chrissy are with the Kansas Hospital Association working on the transfer portion of that. So there's a lot of to-be-determined information coming from that project, and we're doing the best we can in the background with a great team of help to support that. But if people do have questions, comments, things that they'd like for feedback to get to us, we do have the ears and are able to be at the table with a lot of those conversations. So we want to do and represent the best we can for Kansas EMS. One of those, again, things I'd mentioned is sustainability. And as you're looking individually across your rural and frontier EMS community, is when this money does become available quite quickly, and the turnaround to get a project up and running is going to require data and a lot of groundwork to do. One, there's resources through KMSA to help you to secure that. And two is always think about the sustainability when we come 5 years from now and what that looks like. KDHE and all of those responsible for this want to know what that looks like, sustainable, long-term past that 5 years. So with that, anything to add, Joe, that you can think of? Okay. Or do you want to cover that?
So, picking up on the rural health transformation theme, there there's several components that EMS world ought to keep their eye on. I mean, hey, first of all, it's $1.2 billion over 5 years, and we can't grab any of it in the urban area, and neither can Angela in Wichita, and neither can Lawrence Douglas. It is rural. So when you think about how do you use $1.2 billion in Kansas and it can't be used in urban areas, that's a hell of a lot of money to spread around rural Kansas. So keep that in the forefront. There are key issues that KMSA's proposal put in there, workforce development, and that we're tandem up with needing physicians and nurses and RTs. So there's some, we're a component of that. But as that rolls out, EMS educators have got to keep their eye on it because most of those aforementioned programs run through established entities, and there's a lot of ambulance services that do EMT and I think AEMT courses here in Kansas. And so making sure that there's funding support that's adaptable for our needs is very important. Back to Frank and Dave and Chrissy have been pushing and are very much in the mix in those conversations. The transfers, the community paramedic component, Frank was very diplomatic. I didn't get that skill in school. We had to push to get community paramedic put in there, even though the notice of funding, so if you play the grant world, the notice of funding sort of tells you what you should be sending back in. It had community paramedic in it 12 times. So the federal government was looking for community paramedic, and the Kansas response was mobile integrated health / certified medical assistant. Now, I've looked. I can't find one in the country. They don't exist, let alone sustainable funding. So there are some disagreements in policy on this issue. Frankly, KDHE leadership is rock solid on our side of the issue, that the community paramedic program is building out extraordinarily well in Kansas. Four established programs, Olathe's got one, MedAct, but the four rural ones that have gotten going in November and December are going along well. It's early, but that's Norwich, Bennington, Minneapolis, and Dickinson County. They're all tandem up with local public health, FQs, or local hospital, and everybody's smiling at this stage. It's too early to claim success. But the sustainability that Frank hits on is always the key question. It's there. Went live in Missouri on 5 days ago. Yeah, it's brand new. We're part of a clinically integrated network. Don't ask me to define that. I learned it 5 months ago. But essentially, private doctors and healthcare organizations for the last 25 years have bundled together their area of interest and created a CIN, which then negotiates with the health insurance companies on their behalf. So Olathe Fire does not have to have eight different contracts with eight different insurance companies. So it went live in Missouri, 11 agencies under contract. We have one contract with the National Health Insurance, and they are paying $150 an hour for a community paramedic functionality. Will that translate into Kansas? We're working on it. And the negotiations are going on now with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City, and Centene, and then the fourth one sort of in line is Healthy Blue. We've got the experience on the Missouri side. So it's growing out. If we end up with supporting dollars from Rural Health Transformation Fund to help stand up, ask for at least a two-year grant support if you're going to dip your toe in this water, so you get a quarter, a half-time person, and then by then this structural is going to be built out. And we're not alone. They're working on it in Wisconsin and Montana and several states in the east side and Florida. So we're not alone. We are at the bleeding edge, but we're not alone. I'll pause in case you got rural health transformation, and let me cover a couple of quick things on the marker side. We're having a big party in June. It's called soccer. They call it football everywhere else. So the FIFA stuff is rocking and rolling, and it's a lot of fun. I'm not in the thick of it. If you got real questions, ask Dr. Beaver. He is an official with the whole thing, and Chris Wright with MedAct. But the rumor is that there'll be four teams, one in Lawrence, base camping for 30 to 45 days, and they're all bringing their buddies. So last week, the numbers projected to coming to visit for this party went from 650,000 to 1.2 million because apparently, and I'm looking because Joel's may correct me here, of the four that are rumored to be coming, England and Argentina have their biggest parties, and they apparently are the rambunctious partiers, number one and two on the list of rambunctiousness. And then the Netherlands travel with a big party, and that's why they bumped up the numbers coming to party. The local planning, I'm not in the thick of that, but if you need questions, reach out to Dr. Beaver or Chris Wright. He's doing a lot of coordination on a regional perspective, and in-house, KCMO Fire's got some smart talent. They're doing that. But if you got any questions, go to them. Otherwise, it should be an interesting experience, and I hope everybody gets to come participate in some fashion. An outgrowth of that is trying to make sure communications and tracking of patients is in place, and that's Pulsera. We're feeling pretty good about it at this stage in the metro area. KCMO Fire started going live 3 weeks ago with a slow rollout. KCK goes live in March. AMR, Big Service Operations in the Missouri side, goes live in March, MedAct in April. Hospitals, HCA's live, St. Luke's is doing implementation, Advent, some are still in IT and legal. We've really only had one hospital say no, and I suspicion that will evolve over time. So last thing to comment about is the regional effort around pre-hospital blood is moving. I would expect a couple of agencies to go live in the next 60 to 90 days. That seemed reasonable, sir? 90 days? Okay, so probably a couple, and I think you'll see it start on the Kansas side, and then probably, I think a little after that, a good-sized agency on the Missouri side. Interesting set of variables between blood banks and hospital blood managers, and I say it lovingly, if you think you know somebody that's type A, you have it until you've met a blood manager in a hospital. Those folks are type A+. But I get it after sticking my nose in this issue. So as you look downstream, because the functionality of this is not as hard as it appears from the outside. The blood banks have evolved, and they are absolutely open to the conversation. I would say they don't have great playbooks yet. And so there's an awful lot of from ground zero that I would think they'd have playbooks on. But if there's a blood supply in your community, then there is, in my opinion, the ability for you to figure out how to put it in the pre-hospital environment. And the numbers are impressive. The trauma side, the American College of Surgeons uses the figure, if we had a progressive pre-hospital blood administration system, and it would be 10,000 lives a year saved nationwide. And it ain't us old guys, it's young pups. So it's quality of life there. So we're going to try and stay as transparent as we roll along. So as people are wanting to learn, we can put you all in touch with folks. Don't start calling yet, but it's moving and it goes live soon. That's all we've got to bore you with. Unless you got questions or a good argument, we're good there too.
I don't want to argue. Well, I'll augment into on that aspect because it came up with the Advisory Committee on Trauma yesterday and then the Drive to Zero campaign. Both mentioned pre-hospital blood. Probably need to be a larger voice with those entities to say, one, the description, the way that you described it working, where if it's local, if there's blood already present within the community, there should be a way to get it out and being used is the way to approach that. That is not what is being communicated through those other two entities. They are wanting blood on every single ambulance within the state, which we've tried to tell them is not feasible and is not cost effective, and that's going to make your blood bank managers go crazy.
Yeah.
And they're already there. So,
the coordination.
Coordination absolutely yes. Should work. And so that is really the collective message that I think EMS needs to just continually say when it's brought up is the fact of it. it's just not going to work in this one manner. And but yes, the desire is, if it's within the community as a resource, it should be able to be in the pre-hospital setting. So I'm glad you stated it that way.
A lot. So one of our agencies in the Kansas side is already working with two ambulance services next to them because they don't need to do it. I mean, the tracking, the monitoring of that fragile and rare commodity is back to that reason why they're type AA personalities, to monitor that fragile stuff. But are they planning to support them with the blood in their supervisor's vehicle? Yeah, and then this one, yeah, that how to coordinate to make use of it. Yes.
So a couple of comments, which I don't disagree with either of you on. Coordination should be able to occur and should is the but when the folks that are that control the blood bank are not even willing to have a discussion about it, it makes it very difficult to move forward with even trying to put it, implement anything. And when literally presenting that to those folks and not even willing to entertain or discuss it.
Let us have a few more discussions out of, because we've had lots of meetings with blood banks, and so one of my mistakes was I wanted to clarify in writing where they stood, where we stood, and all that, and that sent them into shivers. But we are working extraordinarily well. Now, I may say that's because we got some big hospitals in tow, and it's sort of a, you know, it's nothing against Salina or anybody else, but when we're there, we've got a bunch of docs representing a bunch of big hospital systems, and we've got 35 ambulance services. So ask us again where we are with blood banks, because today I would tell you they're surprisingly better to work with than I expected when we got into this 8 months ago. We've not run into any troubles. And exactly where you are going, their signals to the hospital are central to the success of this.
Sure.
If they don't want to supply the blood to the hospital when they say, hey, we're going to support the EMS by giving them two bags, and I'm not going to want to order whole blood instead of just whatever it was, and blah, blah, blah. But when we've nudged back and said they don't have whole blood, is that going to be a problem? No. We just got to plan and project as they do their blood production stuff. So I think they're more amenable than they were a year ago. But I didn't have my nose under the tent a year ago. But I think it's evolving. But there's a lot to learn between now and another 120 days. Next time we're here, we may have bloody noses, and we've already failed.
I got it from everybody.
I got a few more things. What's up? Kevin said he didn't have anything. Yep. He's such a quiet individual. Just sitting over there.
My word limits up this room.
Right. Now you've just exceeded it. So, I did a conversation, actually, Kevin, from the representative groups triggered some things that did come up yesterday in the Advisory Committee on Trauma and, again, the Drive to Zero Coalition. One, and really it was for CanAIMS to look to see if this is something the board needs to watch at. We're hearing the evolution of electric aircraft, which seemingly seem to be around the size that you guys use a lot of, and whether that's starting to enter into the air ambulance world in any way, shape, or form, especially with two of our aircraft manufacturers here in the state apparently leading production on those. I don't expect an answer today. Craig, clearly, I just kind of threw that. But it was mentioned yesterday from the KDOT aviation side of things, as they're really starting to, let alone the fire services and the emergency response, how do you deal with a fire on that size where basically the battery is 6 to 7 times larger than what's in an electric vehicle? And those things burn forever. So that's kind of the aspect on that one. MIH. We're coming into our renewal period, and I'll tell you that there were only 11 services that reported to us saying that they were doing any type of thing down the MIH pathway. And so the remainder of the services said they weren't doing anything, which we'll do our best again on education-wise to say that, hey, listen, if you're going out and doing fall risk assessments and things like that, which you are when you decide that you're tired of going out there three times a day and you pull the rug that they keep tripping on out of the way and throw it in the trash form, that is still a type of mobile integrated health. Might not be an orchestrated thing, but it is being done. We would encourage our services to go ahead and report that as it's a service that they provide, so we have a more accurate picture of that. If it's not robust, it's not robust, that's fine. But that helps us give information back to KEMS to say, hey, here are some areas where you might want to help on education and target those services to help them move advance. We already mentioned the pre-hospital blood side, but that, of course, is huge on both aspects. The last one is the dashboard that we reported out on, the timeliness to post-crash care that KDOT created. We have moved the needle, I guess, a little bit on that to say they've removed address location for the services that were on the map layer. They're still pretty firmly implanted in the data that they have, and that it being that it's accurate. So we went ahead and provided them what the live look into our system. Well, what the look, I say live look, it's 2019 to 2023. What it looked like from our system for that same time frame on reports submitted to us. So the disparity here, we had roughly about 270,000 crash incidents during that 5-year period. KDOT said that there were just under 90,000 within theirs. It seems odd that we've got more crashes coming from EMS reports than we do crash reports. But that was just one thing that we brought up to them. The time frames, again, I think I mentioned during the last time we mentioned that dashboard, they kind of upped their game a little bit. They've targeted, now target's a horrible word, but it's really, they're wanting to provide education to find out, is the data supporting what's actually going on? So they named 9 counties yesterday that they were going to be looking out to go into to say, okay, here's what our data shows. Is this what you guys are seeing? It's an odd spattering, I'll just say. I got a picture of it right here because that's the only way that you can do that anymore. I'll name the 9 counties. And by odd spattering, where I was going out on that is, it seemed to be around here. So Jackson, Osage, Atchison, Franklin, Pawnee, Stafford, Brown, Greenwood, and Cherokee were their 9 counties that they're looking at. Jackson and Osage are their top two, with a 91-minute 911 call to when they arrive at a hospital. Average is what, according to their data, Osage was the second at 78 minutes. Jackson County does have a hospital within the county, so that one seems very odd. Osage, not so much without having the hospital in there and primarily transporting Topeka, Burlington, or Emporia. But the remainder all have a hospital within their community, so it just seems odd as we're going through. So we encourage them to include EMS as an aspect, all folks that would respond ultimately to the crash within that county, so it may require others from the county that might be performing mutual aid when they do go in and have those discussions and sit. We did ask that we be at least have a seat representation as well, just to be able to throw the comparison data in. And I'll say we looked specifically at Jackson on the one because that 91 minutes seemed really just wrong. Our data is showing 61, which seems, it sounds long, but that once you start looking at the time it takes to process the call, the time it takes to get out the door, the time on scene, and then transport on top of that, it's 60 minutes is pretty fast. So we were more encouraged on that 61-minute side of things to say, that, okay, maybe this is just not an outlier sitting there. But they did their best to take it out. But that's where we're at on that timeliness post-crash care dashboard. They are still open to kind of tweaking that a little bit. We don't, sorry, Craig, there's not 147 air ambulances stationed across the state anymore. So they did narrow that back down to just where the headquarter locations are at. So that should look a little bit better if they haven't got it completely down yet, they will be. So I just wanted to add that those just popped in yesterday. So questions, comments, concerns?
So I do have just a quick update on interoperable radio communications and some things that may or may not be evolving legislation-wise. There's nothing currently, but I know things are being looked at by KDOT, by the state. So the potential of what's going to occur with the necessity of maintenance, upgrades, all the things that go into the state radio system and the 80-some-plus 800 towers throughout the state that are all knocking on the door of 20 years old technology. So there's a significant need, and that is currently a discussion that's occurring with the Kasich group and KDOT, and how that's going to lead. Where that's going to lead, I don't know, and I don't believe that there's anything in writing or a set plan in place yet, but there will likely be something coming. Like I said, I doubt it's this legislative session, but things are moving pretty fast across the street, so who knows? I don't know where that's going to lead, but I do know that in the meetings and the other communication that's been occurring, that is a concern, obviously, for a lot of local entities, local jurisdictions, on what may be suggested or recommended. So I know that the emergency managers group has sent some written documentation back to KDOT or to the group that's overseeing the radio system itself. So just more of a FYI more than anything at this point, something to keep your eye on, something to keep aware of, and we'll try to do our best collectively to get that information sent out to everybody as it starts evolving. And that's all I have. Nothing?
Nothing.
Terry, anything else from you?
No, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, with nothing else on the agenda, we are adjourned. Thank you.